All right, what's going on? This is the QTR Podcast. How the hell is everybody today? Excellent to have you with me. It's going to be a great weekend. It's going to be a great summer, I got a feeling. First and foremost, before I get started, this podcast, like all of my podcasts, brought to you by my supporters, my patrons, people that donate a monthly recurring sum to help support me on Patreon. That link is in the podcast description. And the fine folks who subscribe to my Substack, QTR's Fringe Finance. That link is also in the podcast description. Want to show some love to my longtime supporters. First and foremost, my friends over at JM Bullion, the only place I buy my gold and silver bullion. JM Bullion has been in business for nearly a decade. They've done over $7 billion in sales. They ship discreetly. They turn around my orders quickly. They have reasonable premiums to spot. And I love buying my gold and silver bullion at JM Bullion. Folks, QTR podcast listeners have their own rep at JM Bullion. So if you don't feel like managing the website or ordering online, maybe it's your first time buying gold and silver bullion, they would love to hear from you directly. You can email Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at jmbullion.com. She would be happy to answer all of your questions and put to rest any of your concerns that you may have about buying gold and silver bullion. Just never had a bad experience. They have been longtime supporters of this podcast. So if you're going to buy some gold and silver bullion, no better place to do it than to reach out to my friend Laura or my friends over at JM Bullion and tell them the Q-Man sent you. My friends over at JM Bullion, love you. This podcast also brought to you by my friend George Gammon over at Rebel Capitalist Pro. George Gammon has teamed up with Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh, Brent Johnson, and numerous other experts to help you preserve your wealth in a world of out-of-control central banks. Rebel Capitalist is one of my favorite YouTube channels, and George Gammon is also his other YouTube channel. Tons of content on there for free. But if you sign up as a Rebel Capitalist Pro member, you get live question and answer sessions. You get access to premium research by people like Lynn Alden and Brent Johnson. Access to the Rebel Capitalist Forum, which includes mock portfolios, tons of interesting discussions about macroeconomics. And if you're just looking to understand how the world of central banks work, George Gammon's Rebel Capitalist Pro is a great place to do it. George has been a longtime partner of the podcast. Love him to death, an honest guy to do business with, just like JM Bullion. Absolutely no complaints. And those that are new to me, hello and welcome. Those that aren't new, know that I try to vet my sponsors as well as I possibly can, because in the world of finance, there's tons of bullshit and tons of nonsense. And so the last thing I would ever want to do is muck up the works by promoting somebody or something that I don't know personally or don't believe is conducting business honestly, which is why I've had so few sponsors over the years, but also in the last 5 years, why I don't think I've gotten one complaint from anybody about any of my sponsors. I think one guy sent me one once a while back about some order he placed, and I think we got it hashed out. But other than that, you know, 6 million downloads later and I haven't gotten any complaints, and I take a point of pride in that, in trying to do some due diligence on the people that sponsor my show. It's easy in this case because the people like George Gammon, they're friends of mine. JM Bullion, I've had a relationship for a while. And my Bitcoin sponsor, my only Bitcoin sponsor, the kind friends over at Swan Bitcoin, I also know personally. I trust people like James Lavish, Larry Lepard, Lynn Alden, who I trust are involved with Swan. And so while I can't tell you that Bitcoin investing is always going to be risk-free, because it isn't, what I can tell you is that I've done my best to vet the people over at Swan. And personally, I like Swan's app. If you don't know what Swan is, it is a easy-to-use app that allows you to stack Bitcoin on a routine, recurring basis. You can set it and forget it, like the Ronco Showtime Grill. Put your rotisserie chicken in, set the dial, go walk away and play tennis for an hour, come back, and hopefully you have generational wealth. Look, I'm not a financial advisor. This is not a guarantee. The point is, though, Swan makes it very easy to stack your Bitcoin. They're giving you no fees on the first $10,000 worth of Bitcoin that you stack. And if you use my link, swanbitcoin.com/QTR, it's in the podcast description, or it's over at quotetheraven.podbean.com if you're looking for it and you're on the Substack right now. You can use my link, swanbitcoin.com/QTR, $10 in free Bitcoin immediately just for using that link. So if you're going to get started stacking, give yourself a leg up with a free 10 bucks, and then no fees for your first 10,000. And hey, it's the best I could do. I talked to Corey over there. I talked to Brandon. I know Lynn Alden. I know Larry Lepard. People I trust, products and services that I trust. My friends over at Swan, my friends at JM Bullion, and my dear friends over at Rebel Capitalist Pro. Thanks a lot for sticking with me, guys. Fucking love you. Love that shit. All right. I need to say up front, I am not a financial advisor. This is not financial advice. Please do your own research on anything and everything I ever talk about. Politics, money, medicine, just assume that I'm clueless. Talk to your doctor. Talk to your financial professional. Talk to your therapist. Do whatever you need to do to not take what I'm saying as advice here. I hold no licenses, no registrations with the SEC, with FINRA. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Usual disclaimers apply. Take Tylenol for any headaches. Might offer any cramps. Read words left to right. Slight pause at commas, long pause at periods. All right, let's get started today. All right, well, here we are. We have officially crossed the streams, like they say in Ghostbusters, and come full circle. I am very happy to have with me today Executive Chairman and Co-Founder of MicroStrategy, Mr. Michael Saylor, also known as, you know, Bitcoin Jesus or whatever you're referred to in the community. How are you today, sir?
Hey, happy to be here. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I got to tell you, look, first and foremost, I think that you are setting the bar in terms of people that I have given the most shit to over a prolonged period of time that then were kind enough to turn around and come onto my podcast and have a discussion with me. So I just want to say up front how much I appreciate that and that it doesn't go unnoticed. And I know my listeners appreciate it as well.
Well, whatever's good for Bitcoin.
All right. Well, I'll take it however I can get it. You know, I listened to pretty much everything that you've said in your long form interviews over the last couple of years, and I'm really looking forward to getting a chance to pick your brain because I've amassed a number of questions. I know you're friendly with my friend Larry Lepard. I know that, you know, I'm seeing Bitcoin in a different light than I was, you know, a couple years ago for certain. But for sure, I still have a number of questions. And so before we even talk about that, I just wanted to ask you, what's your take on the macro situation right now in the United States in general? To me, it looks like the Fed is trapped between a rock and a hard place that they're not going to be able to get out of. And just leaving Bitcoin out of the equation for a second, looking at the size of the deficit that we're running and the way that it is accelerating, what's your general feelings about the state of the country economically right now?
I think that they were extremely inflationary from 2020 to 2022 or so, and then they realized that they had a problem, and they've been trying to cure that for the past year and a half. And I think the government's made some progress, but the inflation numbers are still hotter than they want them to be, right? They want 2 and they've got 3 or 3 and change. But even then, I think they'll do everything they can in order to create the appearance of low consumer inflation. So at some point we'll modify the market baskets and the CPI, their PPI, and that's probably occurring at whatever rate it can. And I think everybody would like to just focus the public on market baskets of products that aren't appreciating too much in price and get them to not focus upon the things that are going up in price more. But the bottom line is that it doesn't feel like it'd be responsible for them to lower interest rates. There's some people would like them to raise interest rates. They know they can't afford to raise them. They would love to lower them. The numbers aren't quite cooperating with them. But if we drop coffee out of the consumer price index and then we go find 10 other things that are expensive and drop them from the consumer price index, and Yeah, this all comes down to normalization of life, right? If I imagine that you can live in a 400 square foot apartment built with drywall with a single flat panel screen and boxed manufactured food, I can get the cost of living down. And if I can just replace streaming Taylor Swift video on Netflix with going to see Taylor Swift concert for $500, then the inflation will go away, the CPI will come down, and then they'll probably lower the interest rates a bit. They'll inflate the money supply, and eventually, you know, it'll cost $18 million for a one-bedroom apartment in New York, right? Or maybe it already does, but, you know, I mean, it's the Tokyo model, right? Where interest rates go to zero, stay there for 20, 30 years, and nobody can afford to own anything in Tokyo, but we all collectively act like that's normal.
Well, yeah, and I think, like, with the hedonic adjustments and the leaving things in and out of CPI, I was talking to Matt Taibbi about this a couple weeks ago, how Paul Krugman continually posts on Twitter, hey, if we just remove, you know, Medicare, medical bills, the cost of housing, the cost of coffee, the cost of your morning bran muffin, the cost of
food and energy.
Right.
Get rid of food and energy.
If we just get rid of all these things, everything looks to be fine. And my question, my first sub-question here on this category is, how far can they go with these hedonic adjustments and substitutions before it hits that point in the, like, bullshit laffer curve where people realize they're just getting gamed? Like, psychologically, where do you think that point is?
I think they can go forever, my friend. Like, I don't think... I think they can continue to make hedonic adjustments, right? Why do you need a car? You could Uber. Why do you need to be able to drive? Because there's a self-driving Uber. Why do we need, you know, what happens when we've got one-tenth as many cars and robots drive them? And why do you need to go anywhere in a robot car when you can just watch it on YouTube? And why do you need to even watch it on YouTube, you know, if you can, like, put on, you know, virtual reality glasses? Why do we even need an 80-inch television? So I can take this to ad infinitum to the extreme. I mean, the extreme is like the Matrix, right? It's like,
right,
we just plug in, we jack in something into the back of your vertebrae, and we give you a feeding tube. Why do you really need a steak when you can eat hamburger? Why do you need hamburger when you can eat soy burger? Why do you need soy burger when we could just, like, force feed you some sugar protein concoction or something? So when will that end? I mean, I'm being tongue-in-cheek, but let's just say we won't hit a crisis in the next decade. I mean, that's all that really matters, right? I mean, and then, I mean, planning for 40 years out is kind of academic right now, but I don't think there's any reason why in the next decade anything particularly catalytic will occur in the public consciousness. I think people will just keep, they'll just keep having their expectations renormalized down. And you know, I mean, it's been working just fine for quite a while, don't you think?
Yeah, it has. And it's scary because I've often used the quote that inflation is like, you know, works in the dark machinery of the night, to borrow some Ginsberg, trying to put, like, into words exactly how this all is kind of happening behind the curtain. And the thing that doesn't the thing that changes, it has to be consequential, the fact that inflation is eating away at people's purchasing power. And the thing that changes that people don't notice is their quality of life. And the reason that they don't notice it is because it changes in such small increments. And it's like you're talking about, except it's even smaller than that. You know, first it's a 9-ounce box of cereal for $7.99. Then it's an 8.8-ounce box of cereal for $7.99. Then it's 8.5 ounces for $8.29. And pretty soon you wake up and you notice that you're paying, you know, $30 for half of a candy bar. And to me, you know, I think, jokingly, I say all the time on my blog and on the podcast that we're heading towards that terminus of basically just being the battery in the Matrix, right? But sadly, I mean, look, it's a slippery slope that we're not going to have to worry about in our lifetimes, but it's very difficult. I mean, I don't think it's really conspiratorial to think that that's the hill that we're sliding down, is it? It's just, how long will it take for us to get there?
You know, like, I think it's just, I think it's instructive to look at Japan. Like, what's happened in Japan over the last 30 years? Like I think in 1980, we thought the Japanese were going to take over the world, you know, and at the height of analog electronics. And then all of a sudden, the digital revolution took place and things went differently. But, you know, that's 44 years ago. And so in 44 years, the Japanese government has had what looks to be irrational financial policies in American terms, right? Like interest rates have been too low, you know, and at the same time, you're like, well, how long can this go on? And the answer is you just keep renormalizing until no one expects to own a car. Everyone expects to do public transportation. No one wants to live in a standalone house. Everyone lives in an apartment, then everybody lives in a smaller apartment, then everybody shares their apartment, and then you just don't expect to consume that. And if I just keep, this is just the, what is it, the compression of expectations consistent with the compression of energy and wealth in the civilization, you know. But you know, when I grew up in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, it was a very poor country, really, really poor country when I was growing up there. And the expectation was, no, nobody really, you probably wouldn't own a car, and you would work for your entire life to save up enough money to be able to take a vacation once to the U.S. Like people would literally work for 20 years. And the result of 20 years was I can travel to the U.S. for 3 weeks and come back. So it's not a new thing. I mean, if you look through history, there are lots of examples in history where people's expectations and quality of life was compressed down to the bare minimum, and then it expands and then it contracts. And you know, I'm not here to solve that, right? Like now we're when we go to macro, we're talking about solving the economic problems of the world, very difficult, and then you get into political issues, and that's double difficult. And the truth of the matter is that's a bit above my pay grade. My view is just, yes, there will be inflation. The government will have to keep printing money, and that will cause the price of scarce desirable assets to appreciate. And the rank and file average person will be forced to lower their standards, and they'll have to give up their car, give up their house. You know, I don't know if you live in New York or around New York, but the phrase pre-war, it just refers to good apartments built before we couldn't afford to build them anymore.
Exactly.
It's like before the war, we could afford to do it well or do it right.
With concrete,
and after
right.
And after the war, we started doing it with drywall and plastic and garbage. But, you know, there's a lot of people that live in the non-pre-war apartments, and people just accepted it. And they're like, well, why'd that happen? Oh, well, there's a war, you know. We just can't afford to do it anymore. So right. I think there's a long way to go there, because it's like you used to have libraries. Now you're not getting them. Used to have concerts. Now you're not getting them. Used to have, you know, a lot of concrete and energy. Now you're not going to get it. Well, how far can it go? It can go a lot further. And you can either decide you want to be a politician and you want to fight that, but that's like signing up to enter a political battle.
Right.
Or you can just say, it's going to happen. The only real question is, what's my scarce desirable portfolio of assets that I'm going to buy now with the money I have, with the expectation that people that are richer than me, smarter than me, more cultured than me will want to buy from me in a decade? And that's like, you know, it's like 3 acres in Palm Beach. That's a house in the Hamptons. If you can do it, good for you. Maybe it's scarce desirable art. Maybe it's super high, you know, if you can buy an acre of land in Miami Beach, that went from, $10,000 an acre to $10 million an acre. Maybe that. But can you pay the property tax on it? Can you pay the carry, the maintenance on it? Can you take it with you? There's, you know, if you live in Nigeria, I'll put you in Africa with money. There's nothing you want to buy anywhere in Africa, nothing that you'd want to hold for 100 years if you can't put it in your pocket and leave with it. So your best bet would be maybe you can smuggle out your Picasso. Otherwise, you want to buy Bitcoin. So, you know, what brings us here is I happen to think that Bitcoin is the most scarce, desirable asset that you can own. And it's the economic solution to the macroeconomic problem. And I guess, Chris, what I would say is the world's full of people that point out the problem. It's not hard. Like, it's not, you know, people think that they're brilliant geniuses, that they write a book of 1,000 pages and they critique everything and they point out how effed up the world is. But you haven't really helped anybody if all you do is point out how dysfunctional every single political economic system is. All you've done is observe the obvious. Guess what? In 10,000 years, I can give you 10,000 examples of dysfunctional political systems. It's not new. You didn't discover it. The fact that you can write a book about it makes you like the, you know, the 18,000th person that's observed that. Right. So if you want to actually make a contribution to your friends
calm down.
Or family,
you're going
to
cost me subscribers and listeners.
Yeah, sorry. But my point is we've got a lot of people that just critique the problem. Everybody doesn't need the critique. They know the world's effed up.
Right.
They need the solution. So if you're gonna give me a problem, you need to say there's a problem and the solution is blank. And that last part of the sentence is worth a million times more than the first part of the sentence.
Yeah, of course. You know, as we talk about like the compression of quality of living standards, and then we'll move forward on what you're talking about. But as that, you know, as those walls keep closing in, like that trash compactor in Star Wars, you know, they're just kind of slowly. Where do the cretins in these like unelected globalist organizations like the World Economic Forum fit in? Are they just like, do you think they are purposely kind of on the forefront of that agenda and kind of making excuses for it? Or you just think they're useful idiots that happen to arrive at that conclusion on their own?
I studied system dynamics at MIT, and one of the tenets of system dynamics is just look at the system and the design of the system, and is it inherently stable or unstable, and does it have a tendency towards something? So I think that you can describe all of these phenomena as they're just systems that have a natural tendency toward a certain result. And the people that run all these organizations, they don't think they're the bad guy. They actually think they're doing what is best for their constituency. So let's take big tech. Now there are companies that control what 1 billion people can say. Well, I mean, they start by saying, hey, let's give this thing to 1 billion people. Isn't that cool? And then they get super rich. And then there's a crisis. And then the government says, hey, make sure they don't say this. And then they're like, okay, well, I think we're helping 1 billion people by not panicking 1 billion people. We have 1 billion people in our Colosseum, and someone says, you know, there's a fire and we don't want them to panic and stampede out the doors. So we think we're implementing safety measures to 1 billion people, and that's what they think. But then if you're the person speaking the truth and you get censored, you're like, oh, this is some authoritarian, right, you know, censorship. But they don't think it. They actually think that they're, you know, it's like big government's going to do government, big tech's going to do tech, big defense is going to do that, big medicine. It's like, I invented a drug to help the kids. Oh, I didn't realize that it had side effects, or I did my best. So I think that the world is like, once you create a World Health Organization, they're going to try to do world health, right? And the problem is that I don't know. You read like Nicholas Taleb stuff, Anti-Fragile, Fooled by Randomness. I mean, all of his canon. And, you know, what he says is, in essence, like, people, well-intentioned people doing things are the problem.
Right.
Because, yeah, you know, it's the doing of stuff. It's like if I put someone in charge of the world and I tell them to do good, the odds are they're going to do bad.
Right.
It's like if I said, okay, you are in charge of like determining the curriculum or the education for, you know, 18 million children. Well, good luck with that. But I mean, are you qualified to do it? Is anybody? I mean, it's kind of like, right, the conundrum is central planning.
Right.
Right. I put someone in charge, you know, and we're like, we all know central planning is bad if we're market economists. But the problem is technology naturally centralizes, and eventually the people running Microsoft and Apple and Google and the U.S. government and the World Health Organization and fill in the blank, every big anything, and there's 1,000 big anythings in the world, they're all central planners. They can't not be. Right? What?
Yeah, and you know, it's painting with a very broad brush, in other words.
But I don't ascribe idiocy or malice to them. I don't ascribe ill intent. I actually think they honestly think they're doing the right thing. It's just the system is unstable, or maybe not. You know, can I give you one example? The Twitter cane. You know, stuff was going sideways around 2018 when Twitter got huge, and then there was a hurricane. Was it like Hurricane Irma or something? And the hurricane is forming in the Caribbean, and people are staring at it 2 weeks in advance. So what do we have? We have technology to track a hurricane. Then we have cable weather channels, and they're following the hurricane 24/7. And then you have people tweeting about the hurricane. And if you tweet, and you've got Twitter, and Twitter's wired up everybody. So you've got a very unstable system, like a combination of satellite technology and social media and cable television. And then you have, Lord help you, a state government and a federal government. And if none of those existed, what would have happened is a hurricane forms, it misses Florida, and nobody notices.
Right.
But, and that's what happened 100 years ago or 50 years ago. But in 2018, here's what happened. People notice it because they got satellite. Then the weather person that tweets about it and says, oh, it'll probably miss Florida. Nobody likes that tweet, and that doesn't go viral. So the weather forecaster that tweets, this is going to hit Florida and destroy Miami. It's the big one. You're all going to die. He goes viral. So he goes viral. So the Weather Channel starts covering the Twitter cane. So what happens next? Well, advertisers pile in. Everyone starts watching the Weather Channel. If you actually do a weather forecast, say, guess what? There's storms somewhere in the world. It'll probably miss you. Nobody, they're going to turn the channel. So you get on television and say, hey, there's a storm. But if it hits us, it'll like sink Miami Beach and there's going to be $100 billion of damage. This is a national emergency. Oh, my God. It goes to the White House. It goes to FEMA. It goes to the governor of Florida. Pretty soon, everybody's going nuts. The mayor of Miami. Now the media, you know, the governor says, well, I'm not going to opine on that. And then the media is like, well, you're irresponsible, you know, and we hate you. So the governor's like, I got to have a press conference. So the governor has a press conference and he gets asked about the hurricane. It's like, what steps are you taking to protect the citizens? I'm going to protect the citizens of Florida. We're not going to be asleep on my watch, blah, blah, blah. What happens next? Ratings are going through the roof. Everybody's crazy. The governor's got 10 press conferences. FEMA's involved. Now the White House has got to get involved because they can't get overshadowed by the governor of Florida. You know what they do next? They declare martial law in Miami and Miami Beach. They lock down the city. Then they actually forcibly evict everybody from their house. And they go door to door, knocking on doors, and they evacuate all of Miami Beach. And you get arrested if you don't flee. Meanwhile, there are some random voices saying, you know, it probably will miss us. And it's generally missed us. And if it hits us, it probably won't be that bad. But we really need to shut down the economy of Florida and shut down the city of Miami and evict everybody and suspend their property rights and their, you know, First Amendment rights and their Second Amendment rights and whatever. It's like, well, you know, out of an abundance of caution. So here's how the story ends. Everyone gets kicked out of Miami. They all flee to the other side of Florida, to Tampa and Sarasota. Every single hotel in Florida fills up. The economy is in a shambles. Everybody loses their mind. The hurricane changes direction in the last 24 hours, veers over to the west side of Florida and slams into Sarasota, where everybody's evacuated to, misses Miami, and does no damage. Okay, that was the Twitter cane. And so now, and these weren't blue politicians. These were red politicians. So the point is, okay, who's to blame for this, Chris?
Right.
And what does it tell you about the world?
It speaks to your point, right? It's much to do about nothing. And it's, you know, good intentions. Just, you know, this is like Andy Shechtman. It asked me a couple of weeks, you know, do I think the economy is being tanked on purpose as part of Cloward Piven theory? And I'm like, I just think people are dumb. You know, that's it. I'm dumb. Most other people are dumb. You know, I'm hard-headed. Takes me a while to learn things. And I think you're right. I think it's a...
But, you know, were any of these people dumb? They were, I mean, they were the top of their profession. The mayor of Miami, the governor of Florida, the president, FEMA, all the media, all the Twitter pundits, all the journalists. And the point is, it's a freaking stampede. Like, once you get going and people just, the mob starts moving, maybe a best analogy I can give you is, I feel like, you know, if you look at amoebas, they don't have allergic reactions. But when you get a sophisticated vertebrate, at some point, you know, I can put a peanut, you know, underneath your nose and you go into anaphylactic shock. It's like, okay, so humans are really good at something, but the fact that you'll go into anaphylactic shock because you tasted a peanut and your entire body shuts down and you die,
right?
It strikes you that maybe there's something not that, you know, Darwinian positive about the way that nervous system developed.
Yeah, sure.
It's like it's like an autoimmune disease, or it's a...
like an Achilles heel.
But it does, it is a phenomenon that pops up in a very advanced organism or advanced society, you know, an immunologist or, you know, people that, you know, the paleo health people would say, you should get back in touch with nature, roll around in the dirt, you know, and not be so afraid of germs and life and stress. And this is the message of Taleb and Anti-Fragile and his other books. It's like, you kind of need pain.
Right.
You kind of need a little bit of dirtiness. And then when well-intentioned intellectuals attempt to make all the risk go away, that's what actually creates the instability and the catastrophe. Everybody's trying too hard to manage a perceived potential problem. And it's in their trying that they introduce the systemic dysfunction. And the problem we have today that we didn't have 100 years ago is now you actually have a lot of people, like you have 1,000 people with a lot of power over 1 billion people. And 100 years ago, there was no one that could tell 1 billion people what to think or, you know, what to eat or to be worried about a storm that's never going to hit them. That's a modern thing. And so I don't think of it as malice. I think it's the technology systems that have intertwined to create instability, dysfunction, distortions, and they're going to do what they're going to do. And I don't know if we can rewire the entire human race at this point. I don't, when you've got that problem, it's hard to fix 1,000 of the symptoms, but maybe you can introduce a healthy component that will spread virally, that'll just make everybody holistically a bit healthier than they were.
It just reminds me so much of central banking, because one of the things that I rail about, and not just in the world of finance, is why it's so important to become comfortable with being uncomfortable, and how our incessant, constant fight against any type of comfort, discomfort, or perceived discomfort, especially with politicians, you know, among their constituents, but also that becomes discomfort for them as well, that constantly being on the offensive against any type of perceived discomfort or potential discomfort winds up doing us far more harm than good. And quantitative easing and the way that we run central banking reminds me a lot of that, too. It's like, at what point is the distortion that we're creating, you know, exponentially worse than what we would have been saving ourselves from in what, 2000 or 2008?
Yeah, it's a good segue to Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoin is the decentral bank of the world. And the idea is just leave it alone, right? Leave money alone, leave the capital alone, stop trying to manipulate the cost of capital, stop trying to manipulate the money supply, stop trying to manipulate the marketplace. To stop trying to make volatility go away, you know, one of the tenets, you know, in the fiat world or the traditional world is volatility is bad, but, you know, volatility is bad, stability is good. But the truth of the matter is volatility is good and stability is bad. If stability is sit at your chair 90 hours a week and have your muscles atrophy, whereas how about stand, jump around, sweat, right? Move. And the volatility is actually healthy. That's the message of like an anti-fragile too. That's basically natural organic health, right? I mean, that's almost a definition of life. And we just got too much artificial, right? It's like, do you want to live in a natural world where the weather changes and where you get cold and hot and you get attacked by pathogens and you have to find food and move around and get out of the way? Are you living that world? Or you want to live in an artificial world where you sit in your chair and everything is artificially controlled and all sorts of stress get waved away from you, right? And of course, that artificial world just becomes systemically, you know, progressively more fragile. And eventually it comes crashing down on your head because of the law of nature.
Yeah, and it's, you know, any type of sound money or fixed asset in a system where if you think of the economy as like a closed loop of piping or whatever, where the Fed's job is to basically, basically squelch any type of volatility, right? There you have this vibrant economy with trillions of transactions happening all over the place and all these different variables and indicators. And the Fed's sole purpose essentially is to print money in order to redistribute purchasing power to squelch volatility, then there has to be a blow-off valve somewhere. And I think if you're an asset like Bitcoin or your gold or your real estate or you're some type of fixed asset, you know, you become the consequence almost. Like you become the effect to the cause. You become the blow-off valve from this really like inorganic synthetic kind of squelched volatility in the overall system, you know, like, because it's not natural for an economy, you know, for the VIX to just get pounded into submission every day, right? So the volatility that would have occurred there has to occur somewhere else.
Yeah, like I think that's all true, and I guess what I would suggest though is sometimes we can frame this as just like a fiat versus crypto thing, or Bitcoin versus whatever thing, or the like. But another way to frame it, which I think is a bit more constructive and cheerful, is Bitcoin's digital capital, and that means that we're pursuing two virtues in the world. One virtue is we want to take physical things and make them digital. Right. And the other virtue is we want to make all sorts of heterogeneous assets, whatever they might be, heterogeneous materials in the economy, and convert them into capital, into pure economic energy. So capitalism is about, you know, shuffling resources in society around for the good of the society and to make, you know, and to generate a profit. And that's been well understood. Bitcoin is being driven by a number of things. One is, you know, if an inflation of the currency is high in whatever the country is, well, then using a fiat currency as a capital asset becomes more and more, more and more inefficient. So obviously in hyperinflation in Nigeria or in Lebanon or in Argentina or Venezuela, then there's kind of a stampede away from that currency to some other form of capital, right? And so inflation will drive it. But the other thing that will drive the success of Bitcoin is it's not just the inefficiency of central government, central banking planners. You know, every corporation, I mean, look at TikTok versus Twitter versus Meta and Facebook and Apple and YouTube. And think about the travails of operating a corporation in the global economy. You know, you're being pulled and pushed between the EU and China, you know, and will Apple stores unionize, and you know, will Amazon unionize? You've got unions, you've got competitors, and you know, is the iPhone 87 going to be something you need to buy? And so corporations are centrally planned organizations as well. And you know, you remember what happened to Kodak and Xerox? Yeah. Like they were all run by Well, everyone at the top of a corporation is the number one selection out of 10,000 possibilities. They rose to the top of that organization. But what's the useful life expectancy of a company, right? So if you're investing your capital in a company stock, right? Name a company, you know, a stock that lasts 100 years. It's a good investment. It's tricky. So capital is flowing out of currencies, but it's also going to flow out of equities. And then capital is all we have monetized or capitalized real estate. You know, there's the stories about the Chinese going into Canada, buying up all the real estate, you know, and then there's the stories about, you know, Blackstone buying up all the apartment buildings and, you know, and commercial real estate gets monetized. And, you know, if you go to 10,000 rich families in the world, you'll find, I don't know, at least half of them have massive property portfolios. And if you ask them why, sometimes they'll say, oh, I just love to do property development. But a lot of people just think it's a store of value. It's just a way to protect their wealth over time. And so you have capital in currency and in bonds. You have capital in equity. You have capital in property and real estate. JP Morgan runs, you know, alternative investments conference. And everybody's just ferociously, enthusiastically looking for something to invest in that's not risk assets in the stock market.
Right.
So I just find me anything to buy. Okay. So, well, and what are those things? Okay. Take all, I give you a bunch of money, $100 million, and I give you a choice. You want to buy classic art? You want to buy music rights? You want to buy mineral rights? You want to buy equity? You want to buy real estate? If so, where? You want to buy land? You want to buy apartments? You know, it's every one of these things is complicated. Every one of them has risk. And so Bitcoin, it represents a pure capital asset. It's like there's no management team. There's no nexus. There's no physicality. It's a very simple idea. You know, the failure rate of corporations, you know, of small startups is 99.9%. The failure rate of big companies is 99%. The failure rate of the S&P 500 to beat the hurdle rate is 99%. There's like seven companies to beat the hurdle rate in the S&P 500. So really, if everybody's failing or, you know, to beat that hurdle rate, then the best way to win the game is don't play the game. Right. So what you have is you have a set of flows out of currencies, but you also have a lot of capital flows out of all the equities and properties and other assets. And then third, and that's all the capital transformation, right? The economy is transforming from imperfect, heterogeneous, defective capital assets to this perfectly engineered 21 million capped capital asset. It literally is the on paper, mathematically, it is the best capital asset because it's not there's no elasticity to price. So now, by the way, as an aside, look what just happened in GameStop this week. You know, it's all these degens pile into GameStop, and then the companies announce an ATM to dump a bunch of equity on the market. And you're like, duh, I could have predicted that one, right? So you don't really want to capitalize assets that have a supply elasticity to price. And that takes me to the digital revolution. The other dynamic in the 21st century is everybody successful transforms something from analog to digital. You know, it's like digital photos, digital music, digital education. Just look at these AIs. You know, the cars are going to drive themselves. The teachers are going to be AI teachers. It's pretty obvious to 8 billion people that if you can do something digitally for a nickel of electricity instead of pay $500 for a real person, that they want that. So Bitcoin is being driven not just by, you know, central planners that are ineffective. I mean, that's getting wrapped around the axle on that is just getting stuck in the macroeconomic complaining mode. Forget about that. You're not fixing the macro economy. You're not going to eliminate storms, tornadoes, political dysfunction, or the tendency of the human race to disagree or go to war. That will not go away. What you're going to do is you're going to take advantage of the fact that you have a mathematically better capital asset, and then you're going to jump on to the wave of digital transformation of capital. right? We've already transformed all the information. What happens when you digitally transform the capital assets from analog to digital? Now I've got a $1 billion building, but I teleport at the speed of light. Now I've got $1 billion of gold and I can store it in my head. Now I have $1 billion worth of bonds or $1 billion worth of another asset, but I can program it on a computer, you know, and trade it 87,000 times a minute. And, you know, it does take a rocket scientist to figure out that if I can move the capital 1 million times faster and cheaper than the rate at which you can move $1 billion of gold, or the rate at which, how do you buy a building and sell it and decompose it 18 million times on Saturday? It's not happening. So none of this stuff is like anti-central planning, doom and gloom, right? It's just a better technology. And if there's $400 trillion of capital, liquid capital floating around in an economy of $900 trillion in assets, what happens if I just pull the $400 trillion worth of economic energy out of the property, the equity, the bonds, the art, the collectibles, the derivatives, the blah, 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 and I put it into a digital format where I can program it and I can move it around and handle it faster? That's extremely exothermic or whatever. It just generates huge amounts of wealth and energy. That, you know, that's what made Apple a $1 trillion company. That's what made Google a $1 trillion company. That will make Bitcoin a $10 trillion, then $100 trillion network, because it's just solving the issue of capital preservation and capital management in a world that needs capitalism.
All right, there's a lot there that I want to respond to. Essentially is riding the wave of the system that's already there, as a solution. I want to just go back to GameStop real quick. I wrote an article a couple months ago called "The One Catalyst That I Think Could Standardize Bitcoin." And the point of the article was, you brought up these people that are piling into GameStop. And I asked myself, years ago when this first happened, but also now again, what are these people pissed about? They're fighting against the institution, they're fighting against Wall Street, they're fighting against the man, but what are they, do they really understand what it is that they're fighting against, and what are they really, angry with? And years ago, I came to the conclusion that I think a lot of these people are, disproportionately negatively affected by the consequences of monetary policy, and I think they're lashing out as a result of that, not necessarily, because they hate short sellers or they hate Ken Griffin, but just because they kind of feel trapped in the system that they know is kind of unfair, but they can't really put their finger on why. And I guess what I'm asking is, when the next crisis happens, whether it's real estate or sovereign debt or whatever, if the 2008 version of 2008 happens in 2024 or 2025, is it possible that these people see Bitcoin as the solution this go round, as the exit ramp, and that could really catalyze adoption further? Or do you think I'm off base?
The people piling into the meme stocks, they have the it's what is the word? They have the right idea, but it's the wrong execution. It's like, I understand their motivation. It's like they're angry with the system. And so they ought to be buying Bitcoin if they were smart, right? The people that have that sentiment, that are unhappy with the status quo, that are smart, are buying Bitcoin. And the ones that are simply angry, but they haven't thought very deeply about what's going to happen, is they're buying these meme stocks, right?
What are they pissed about to begin with, you think?
They feel disenfranchised. I mean, there's a combination, right? They want to make money. They feel disenfranchised. They feel like the system is rigged against them. They're irritated, at the establishment, right? There's a million of these motivations, and they're expressing it. They're expressing their sentiment through their trading of meme stocks. But the problem is, if you increase the size of, if you increase the value of a company by a factor of 10 in excess of its true value and cash flow potential, then the management team of the company just prints 10x more stock, right, and then the stock price crashes.
And management
the reason
gets
that,
paid.
Well, not only do they do it, it's they have a fiduciary obligation to do it. Like if my company's worth 10 bucks a share and you drive the stock to 100, then they've got to issue equity because, you know, that's their job. And so it's really kind of silly to express that sentiment by buying an equity, because equities aren't scarce. There's no Satoshi is not going to double the supply of Bitcoin if you pile into Bitcoin. That's that the whole point. The reason it's a commodity is there's no one that can rug pull you, and there's no one that can inflate the supply. So if you're going to withdraw your capital from whatever you're currently invested in protest, you should put your capital into a property network or into an asset which is scarce. I mean, the truth is they'd be better off to find some kind of exclusive community and all just jointly agree to move to that community, buy up all the houses, knowing that you can't make any more houses. And you see that in like elite communities, like everybody buys up all the houses, and then the price of the 99th house sets the value for all the houses in the neighborhood.
Right.
At least there you have a chance. But, you know, if you did it, if you do it on a stock and the stock float's going to double after you do it, then what are you thinking? Right. So it doesn't make sense. So back to your other point more constructively. Yeah, at some point, as they get more educated, they're going to realize that the right thing for them to do is stop playing the conventional game that they can't win and switch to playing a game they can win. Bitcoin's a monetary union. You're joining a union. The more people that join with their money, the more powerful the network gets.
Right.
The more powerful the network gets, the richer everybody gets, right? So it is a virtuous cycle, and it simply spirals up with some volatility as more people get the idea, right? And that's why Bitcoin is successful, right? Just a question of how long will it take for people to understand that it is the alternative to their to a life of desperation and frustration.
Well, and once you start to understand, I mean, one of the things that did it for me, you know, 6 months ago when I really started to pour a lot more energy into trying to understand it further, not just the idea of redundancy with security, which I find, you know, attractive, but also really the idea that it does really put the, like you said, it's a monetary union. You know, it returns power to the people if they want it. It will work if people want it to work. And like you said, the more people that become a part of the network, the stronger the network gets. And then the more people have a vested interest to pour resources back into the network to, you know, like you're doing with MicroStrategy, turning it into a development company, you know, because in part you want to help do your part to secure the network, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, there's this phrase smart money. Well, so I guess I would offer this metaphor, Chris. Like if there were 100 wealthy families and nobody trusted the government and nobody trusted the bank and they didn't trust each other and they sat around and they said, we'd like to create some bank of our own and some way to protect our wealth for the next 1,000 years.
Right.
Well, if God came down from heaven and said, okay, guys, I'll run Celestial Bank for you. I'll issue, you know, God tokens, 21 million of them, and then I will move them back and forth and make sure nobody cheats anybody, and I'll store your money in heaven. Well, I mean, people might take him up on that or her or whatever you believe is God. But the truth is, you know, there's no deity that's going to run that bank for you. So the second best idea is I actually create the software to do it. I program in 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis or 21 million Bitcoin. And then nobody trusts anybody else. So everybody runs a copy of the bank. And all the copies, all the nodes of the bank check each other. And somebody cheats, they get kicked off the network. It's like, even if I did trust you, I don't trust your great-great-grandson, you know, three times removed. I mean, how do you even know who's going to be running the thing in 100 years? So Bitcoin really is kind of like that cooperative bank secured by cryptography, by semiconductor technology, by energy. It's not a complicated idea. It really comes down to, okay, I give you that bank. It's a fair bank. Nobody can cheat anybody else. Nobody can make any more money, and everybody's got full transparency, and it works anywhere in space and time, and there's no reason why it wouldn't keep working for 1,000 years. That's one idea. And the other idea is you take your chances by buying Picassos, or use the local currency or the local bank, or you invest in a company and you hope that you don't get banned, or you don't get, you know, there's no war. And you know, that's the other idea. That's the 20th century idea. And you just do the best you can. So people will do some amount of the 20th century physical thing, but you're just always having to manage some crisis. There's always going to be a problem, either a physical crisis or a political crisis or economic crisis or currency crisis or competitor crisis. You can either do that, or what if I just don't want to – I don't want to be an investor. I don't want to be a hedge fund. I don't want to guess. I don't want to be a speculator. I don't want to run my own business. I just want to put my money in a bank in cyberspace and have it there for 100 years. And Bitcoin is that second idea. And it's a very powerful, profound idea. Once you get your head around it, you're like, well, if I was smart and I had money, why wouldn't I want that? And the answer is you would. And then you're like, and then the only question becomes, well, there's 10,000 cryptos. They all kind of be better than Bitcoin. Is Bitcoin the one, or should I go for yo-yo coin or dog coin or whatever coin, jerky coin? And so you have to sift through that and figure out which one's the winner. But, you know, now this is not that hard. The SEC has designated the winner for you, you know, like the Millennium with $2 billion invested in Bitcoin is telling you what the winner is. MicroStrategy investing $7.5 billion of real money is we're signaling to you that maybe you don't have a strong opinion. We have a strong opinion. I'm willing to bet $15 billion or $30 billion or X billions of dollars on this one. And if you don't have any opinion, then maybe you just kind of go with the crowd that's already put the $1 trillion up, taking the risk. And if you're not 100% sure about us, maybe you think we're 90% likely to be wrong. Okay, well, bet 10% of your money on it. If you think I'm 95% likely to be wrong, take 5% of your wealth, put in Bitcoin. If I'm right, you're winning. And if I'm wrong, you've still got 95% of your money. But that's kind of the shelling point here, right? That's people need a way to make a decision. And the smart money has chosen this crypto network. And it's pretty obvious the world needs a solution to competition and chaos and confusion. The more chaotic and confused the world is, the better. Like let me say it one more way. It's like if there's a war going on and there's chaos and confusion and there's a tornado and, you know, and people are out there killing each other on the streets, probably the wisest thing for you to do is stay home. Like not go out, right? You're not going to open your donut shop today. You're not going to go adventuring across the country. Doing of nothing starts to look pretty lucrative when the world is in a chaotic furor. And so the more chaotic the world is, the more useful it is to do nothing. And Bitcoin and the idea of sound money is this basic principle that I've got some money. What am I going to do with it? I'm going to do nothing. I'm not going to lose it. It's like do no harm, right? That's the idea. And most people's egos are so great that they just can't live with the notion that the most lucrative thing they could do is do nothing. And the sad fact of the matter is, like, I give you $1 billion and I say, go invest in your best idea in Africa, and it won't be as good as just buying Bitcoin and waiting. Right? I mean, doing nothing is better in many, many circumstances. And that's what Bitcoin is proving to the world right now.
I want to go back to something you were talking about. You mentioned Picasso, and this morning I was listening to the Zero Hedge Bitcoin debate with Eric Voorhees and Peter Schiff and Noriel Roubini.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea, the discussion they were talking about, and one of the things that I still am working to wrap my head around is the idea of intrinsic value. And, you know, I was thinking as I was running, you know, these Picassos that trade hands for $50 million a painting, $30 million a painting, which, you know, for decades now have been considered wonderful inflation hedges. Every time I read about alternative investments, whether it's Scotch or Rolexes or, you know, paintings. But the art world's something I never understood, Michael. And so when I think about how a Picasso could trade hands for $50 million, right? But what do you got? You got a canvas and you got some paint on it. But, you know, I hear these arguments about, well, it doesn't provide a service. It's not, you know, it can't be used in industry. It can't, you know, a painting to me, to somebody that's not an art lover, is nothing. Okay.
Right.
But if I have a painting that people, you know, where does that intrinsic value come from? And can you draw an analog between that and Bitcoin for me to kind of make this make sense? Like, where the hell does art's intrinsic value come from?
Yeah, well, I guess what I would say here is, there's a monetary premium ascribed to the Picasso because it's deemed to be scarce and desirable and portable. So it passes the Bernard Arnault test. And the Bernard Arnault test is, I want to buy something that a person richer than me, more cultured than me, will want to buy from me in a decade. So you ask the question is, would someone with a lot of money want to own this? Well, it's just, it's a scarcity collectible for cultural reasons, but it's only valuable to people in the Western culture that appreciate that form of art. So it's really a specialized property asset or specialized collectible. And it's not new. In fact, if you roll the clock back 500 years, I think Velázquez, it's very famous note in Durant's story of the Renaissance. He writes that, you know, the great court painter in the Spanish court, he went to Rome to buy masterpieces with the king of Spain's checkbook, and nobody would sell him anything because the rich in Italy kept these paintings as a store of value and inflation hedge in the 16th century. So if you have to flee with your life, and they had to do it all the time, if you get kicked out of your city, you have to leave your real estate behind. You know, maybe you carry your gold, but, you know, gold is heavy. And so you take a painting, you roll it up, and you're most – even today, if you were a rich person and you're living in a country, pick the country, and the government collapses, you know – what would you rather have, $1 billion of gold? Would you rather have 20, $50 million paintings? Would you rather have $1 billion of a company in that country? Would you rather own $1 billion of real estate or buildings? Do you want to own $1 billion of oil? You know, what are you going to be able to get out of the country? Your best hope is roll up the Picasso in a tube and smuggle it out of the country, right? That's your best hope. So in terms of economic density, And you know, you're like, well, why does anybody else value it? Well, bragging rights. It's a trophy asset. Like, you know, why does someone value owning a football team? Or why do they value owning a copy of the Magna Carta? You know, it's like, well, at the end of the day, it's because you have 10,000 billionaires. And once you have that many billionaires, they will allocate 5% of their wealth to those kind of collectibles because they can, right? And so it's not the world's best capital asset, right? You're not going to capitalize Microsoft with art. Doesn't make any sense because the art auctions are probably all rigged, right? I mean, it's an unregulated market. It's not liquid. They're not fungible. They're specialty. There's all sorts of uncertainty. So,
right.
You know, if you read the history of the Renaissance and you get to the point where the Holy Roman Empire sacks Rome and they murder, rape, and pillage everything, you can see the appeal of like fleeing the town with your art. I mean, you can see the appeal of that. But Bitcoin's a better idea. Bitcoin is the idea of a fungible capital asset that all of the wealthy, powerful, educated people in the world are going to want, that you can actually teleport out of the country in a few minutes. So I think ultimately these guys get caught up in intrinsic value. And of course, the best money has zero intrinsic value. It's all monetary premium. That's the best money. It's pretty obvious. What I write you a check for, for $1 billion, and the intrinsic value of the paper is nothing, right?
Right.
And the check is worth $1 billion, and so it's a very lightweight way. And if on the other hand, I give you $1 billion worth of oil, or better yet, $1 billion of dirt, it's got intrinsic value, but who wants $1 billion of dirt, right? I mean, like, it doesn't make a very good capital asset. How do I move $1 billion of dirt around from point A to point B without spending $50 million on bulldozers, right? So the point really is, and these guys miss it completely, it's we're trying to actually capitalize the economy with a digital asset. And if I have $10 billion and it's sitting, if I have $10 billion and it's sitting in land in Alabama, there's no way that a fast money trader in Singapore is going to come up with a way to develop my land in Alabama such that it makes me rich. Why would he? Right? It's physical.
Right.
So that's why, how about land in the Antarctic? If I have, I'll give you a simple thought experiment. I take $10 billion of Bitcoin to the Antarctic, and then I bury it, and then I wait 50 years. You think the value of it's going to be higher or lower in 50 years? I go buy $50 billion worth of land in Antarctica, and I wait to see whether other people in the country or the world go and develop the land in Antarctica. And of course, the answer is the global property, the global property is in demand in London, Paris, New York, San Francisco. When Apple Computer builds Bitcoin into the iOS, the Bitcoin buried, in cold storage, literally cold storage in Antarctica, is going to go up in value by a factor of 20 because of something done by some techies in a place that they don't even know about.
Right.
And so the capital markets are a lot more efficient if you have a global capital market that's a digital capital market that's pure and fungible. Right. And that's the idea of Bitcoin. It's just a better idea. Right. And that's why it's good for the world.
And that's something that, you've said on other podcasts before, that, it's just whether I like it or not seems to be the path that we're going down. Like, there will be a Bitcoin wallet on every Android phone that, winds up in Africa. I mean, it seems like a foregone conclusion, especially with the SEC, like you said, coming out and blessing the ETFs, with Millennium coming in and buying billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin. I just want to ask, with the approval of the ETFs, I've heard a lot of people make the point that that could be a negative, against the decentralization argument, because now you have all this Bitcoin centralized in one place. You have these massive, massive buyers. So, ostensibly, if the government wanted to abscond with that Bitcoin, it would know where to get it all. It could just go tap BlackRock or go tap, one of these giant funds. What do you think about that?
Like on Twitter, everybody that, you remember the Twitter cane? It's like, if you forecast the hurricane destroying Miami, you go viral and you get followers. And if you point out it's a non-issue, then no one pays attention to you and you get ignored. So here come the ETFs. And if you go like, oh yeah, well, this is just endemic, or this is just emblematic of continued adoption of Bitcoin. And guess what? There's 300 million companies in the world. There's 8 billion people in the world. There's 50,000 institutions in the world. They're all going to adopt Bitcoin one way, shape, or the other. This is just one more Bitcoin application. There's 18,000 other ideas I have. These guys are buying Bitcoin. Big deal. Okay. It's going to drive up the price of Bitcoin. The network, doubled in market cap. It created, those ETFs, if they drove the price of Bitcoin from 40,000 to 60,000, they created $400 billion of value. Okay, how much money did the investors in the ETFs make in that time period? about, you can mathematically figure it out. There's like 50, 60 billion in the ETFs, 50 billion. So maybe they made 15 billion. Maybe. So maybe 10 billion. So people that invest in the ETFs made 10 billion. The people that hate the ETFs, that are complaining about it, that are non-participants, they made 400 billion. So Chris, so what's the problem again? Like, at the end of the day, you can mathematically figure it out. The ETFs alone, 2 or 3% of the Bitcoin network. Maybe they'll get to 5%. So if they get to 5%, they're going to have to increase the price of Bitcoin by a factor of 10. When they do that, that means that the other 95% of the Bitcoin network is going to make $8 trillion.
Right.
Okay. So how many people are tweeting that if their worst fears are realized, and if the ETFs start buying up, they buy 10% of Bitcoin, then that will be a transfer of $10 trillion of economic power to the people that don't like ETFs?
Nobody. Well,
everybody's just kind of alarmist over this because it's provocative and they get clicks. And the first 10 years or first 15 years of crypto, it's kind of dominated by crypto anarchists, libertarians, and they don't trust corporations, and they don't trust governments, and they don't trust currencies, and they don't trust banks, and they don't trust Wall Street. And they want Bitcoin. And now along comes a corporation, and the corporation wants to be a Bitcoin holder, and people aren't sure how they feel about that.
I think a lot of like people that are critical, including myself, you know, are critical coming from an honest standpoint. Like, you know, certainly I never was trying to be sensational. I just thought I was right. And so I think there are a fair amount of people, like you say, that are out there just doing it for the clicks also. But I do think there's a fair amount of people out there that really, truly, you know, like Peter Schiff truly does believe that he's right, just like you truly do believe that you're right. And I think that, you know,
I don't dispute that. I mean, I think everybody's living in their world and they're doing what they think is the most appropriate thing and trying to be the best version of himself they could be.
Yeah,
I agree with you on that.
How does Bitcoin homogenize itself, like in the KYC AML world? You know, Nouriel Roubini was arguing with Eric Voorhees about the fact that, you know, Eric Voorhees essentially making the argument that it's great for all of the transmissibility reasons, the fact that, look, you can take $1 billion from here to Tokyo, whatever. And Nouriel Roubini is saying, look, all you're doing is stepping outside of the checks and balances of KYC and AML. And so, for Bitcoin to kind of get too big to fail and to thread itself into the U.S., you know, the SWIFT system, the economies, the global economy, how does it homogenize itself with the regulations that are already in place?
Well, I think it's doing it now. I mean, you're watching it, right? For example, sure. Block sells $10 billion worth of Bitcoin every year via Cash App. Okay, they're a publicly traded company. They abide by AML KYC. They have compliance. They have responsibilities, right? There's certain things they won't do in New York State because of state laws. So, you know, Coinbase is handling Bitcoin. They're in a continual dialogue with the SEC. It's sometimes confrontational, but you know, you've got them working on it. Fidelity Digital Assets is custodying billions and billions of dollars of Bitcoin. I'm sure they got an army of lawyers and finance people thinking about it. You know, so their standards are different than, you know, Brazilian banks, Nubank, Bank Itaú. You know, these guys have a different approach. They've got different regulators. Then you've got, you know, African exchanges. Then you've got, you know, you've got players in China and everywhere else in the world. Hey, it's a complicated or a complex market, dynamic, Darwinian, ever evolving, and every corporation brings its own set of constraints to the table, right? I mean, a company in France has a different set of constraints than a company in the U.S., and a company in New York has a different set of constraints than a company in California. You know, and that's different than Cuba, and that's different than Venezuela. So I think that, again, my observation is people all want to centrally plan and centrally criticize. They want to worry about everything. And they, you know, they're worried that, you know, such and such, you know, might not be good for Bitcoin. But at the end of the day, just about everything's good for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin gets stronger every single time someone decides to buy it, trade it, sell it, handle it, talk about it, you know, in any particular way. So there is no one answer, but I mean, it's pretty obvious that Coinbase and Fidelity offering institutional services in the U.S., that was good for Bitcoin. Right. There's no way MicroStrategy could buy Bitcoin if we didn't have institutional custodians that were regulated. It's pretty clear MicroStrategy is good for Bitcoin because people that hate Bitcoin have the ability to short our stock and they buy Bitcoin. Right. People that, you know, it's like we're a gateway for people that like it, hate it, want to trade it, want to sell volatility. And so we gave them another on-ramp. And then it's pretty clear that BlackRock and Fidelity's ETFs are good for Bitcoin because they make access 100 times quicker and easier. You know, the crypto community, they oftentimes fixate on, well, this is not how we would do it. But the point is the crypto community is already fully invested. They've run out of money, right? I mean, everyone that believed in Bitcoin, you know, before the year 2024 had already invested all the money they had in Bitcoin. So these ETFs, they're not really competing with the traditional crypto exchanges or the traditional self-custody or all the other traditional views. The ETFs just brought a new pool of money. They brought, you know, 60 to 80 year old, you know, retirees that have money with a broker that want to buy some Bitcoin that either will buy it through the ETF or they won't. And so when a guy, you know, Millennium buys $2 billion of spot Bitcoin exposure, the amount of Bitcoin they would buy on a crypto exchange is exactly zero. Zero. It's like either zero or 2 billion. So when they buy the 2 billion, they drive up the demand for Bitcoin, the asset, they drive up the Bitcoin price. And that means that the 98% of the market that isn't exposed to the ETFs, they're the beneficiaries of the fact that some new pool of money gets involved. And so it's not just that these new products attract new pools of capital. They also bring with them legitimacy. Right. That's why CNBC wants to talk about this all the time. I mean, that's why, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate just voted in favor of Bitcoin custody for banks. Right. Why? Because of the ETFs. If there were no ETFs, there would be no reason for banks to custody this stuff. There's massive demand now because now you've got BlackRock and Fidelity and every other big Wall Street firm that's about to attract another $500 billion or $1 trillion in the asset. And that attracts the banks, and the banks that then, you know, have a vested interest, and that gives their banks, you know, didn't Chuck Schumer vote in favor of basically Bitcoin custody and repealing SAB 121? So you have a political dynamic here, which is driven by all of these various applications and products and services. And ultimately, you don't have to agree. Like, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, agree with everybody on everything in the Bitcoin ecosystem. It doesn't matter. What matters is there's a diversity of products and services, and they all share in common one thing, which is they're using Bitcoin as a capital asset, and thereby increasing the demand for a scarce asset, driving the price up, increasing the economic power of the network to the benefit of every participant.
Yeah, as far as adoption goes, I mean, I'm not sure if you can't see adoption. I mean, look, when you're on a long adoption curve, sometimes it's very difficult to see adoption. If you can't see adoption now with what's going on with Wall Street, it's difficult for me to, you know, look, I'm a bit lunkheaded when it comes to this, but even I see it. All right. Like when they approved the Bitcoin ETFs, that feels like an inflection point to me. First off, I want to ask, what do you think the next nation state will be to adopt Bitcoin?
I think with nation states, it's very, it's very politically challenging, and this, you know, for them to do this, and it's very, you know, what is the word, controversial. So here's what I think you'll see next. I think you'll actually see sovereign wealth funds that kind of work for nation states start to allocate to Bitcoin as part of their portfolio, right? So if you look at all the sovereign wealth funds that you can think of, you know, it's not controversial to buy $1 billion of Apple stock or buy $1 billion of Microsoft or something like that if you're Norway. But, you know, if this thing evolves as, you know, we allocated to Bitcoin because it's digital capital or a digital asset, just like we allocate to Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Tesla because we're riding the digital wave, I think that goes smoothly. I mean, I think that, you know, you're not going to see anybody put out a press release saying we decided to sell treasury bills to buy Bitcoin. You know what I mean? That's just too controversial.
Right.
Right. And I think my point really is, why do you want to take the controversial combative position when there's actually a cheerful, constructive position? There's nobody in the world that's against technology to make our lives better. If you're like, I got digital technology to make your life better, you know, do you want it? Well, communists want it, capitalists want it, socialists want it, the Chinese want it, the Russians want it, the Americans want it, the South Americans want it, dictators want it, Democrats want it, right? So why don't you just give people better living through technology? And then, and that's what will happen with nation states. I think you'll see that, you know. Otherwise, it's like the alternative, it would be brilliant to print currency and buy Bitcoin. Yeah, a mid-sized country that can print their own currency and buy Bitcoin, they'd be doing something brilliant. I'm just not holding my breath on that just because Chris, before that happens, there are 2,000 companies in the Russell 2000, and every one of them is run by a CEO with a board of directors and a CFO. They've only got 7 people to convince. They could print their own currency and buy Bitcoin, right? Just issue stock, buy Bitcoin, and they could 10x their stock. Okay, so rather than sit around lamenting why country XYZ doesn't do this, a more productive thing to do is ask the question, which company in the Russell 2000 will do what MicroStrategy did? Because the big idea, the simple idea is, I print $1 billion of, you know, like GameStop. The problem with GameStop is they've got no business to invest in. They ought to issue the stock, buy Bitcoin, and then they've got a use of proceeds. So if you're a country or a company, you have the option to either issue your currency or to borrow cheaply, right? Cities, states, countries can borrow, you know, sovereign debt, municipal bonds, et cetera. They can all borrow money and buy Bitcoin, and Bitcoin's returning 40%. Nobody's cost of capital is 40%. It's not generally, not in U.S. dollar terms. So everybody can borrow cheaply and buy Bitcoin if the light bulb went off, and they could issue currency and buy Bitcoin. But I prefer to focus upon the constructive and what's practical. What's practical, you want to make $1 billion, you find a $100 to $300 million company or $1 billion company, and you have them issue $500 million of stock and buy Bitcoin, or roll $500 million of their treasury into Bitcoin, or sell a bond, a convertible bond, pay 2% interest, issue $500 million of converts, struck up 30% premium or 40% premium, and then buy Bitcoin with it. Bitcoin appreciates 24% a year. It'll double every 3 years. It'll double twice in 6 years. You issue a $500 million bond, you get back $1.5 billion on the back end, and you pay 2% interest. So I wouldn't really fixate upon why don't these countries get it, right? You're framing this as some geopolitical social struggle, and you're wanting to fix the Federal Reserve and fight the creature from Jekyll Island, and I like that. It's just not a fight worth having. I mean, I don't want to be a martyr. I want to be a winner. So rather than try to right the wrongs of the world as you see them, why don't you find some sleepy zombie public company that can issue debt and equity? that stock, you know, these stocks trade 5 million a day. These companies stock trade 5 million, 10 million a day. They're dead money, no volatility. No one cares about them. And Bitcoin has 50, 60 vol. So look at the MicroStrategy story, Chris, which is, do you know today MicroStrategy stock out-traded Walmart, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, ExxonMobil, Citigroup, JP Morgan, Nike, Visa, right? Every major large cap company is trading less than MicroStrategy today. And what is the lesson from that? It's like they're not volatile, they're predictable. There's no reason to trade them. And we've just embraced a new idea. Instead of running from volatility, by the way, Microsoft is a classic non-volatile. I own T-bills on my balance sheet, and then I sell three-year contracts, enterprise agreements to my customers. And a good CFO can predict plus or minus 1% or 2% what the quarterly result's going to be a year from now, right? The only variable that moves is cost, and they control it. So that's conventional corporate thinking as exercised by 10,000 companies. How about unconventional corporate thinking, which is, why don't you actually, instead of buying back $100 billion of Apple stock, why don't you buy $100 billion of Bitcoin? And then when Bitcoin fluctuates 5%, you're going to have plus or minus $10 billion of volatility. The stock's going to trade. The options will come to life. Then you could just do it again. Right. I mean, and of course, Apple doesn't need this. I mean, Apple's a monopoly and they're more powerful. They're one of the most powerful companies ever in the history of the world. They don't need it. But the people that need it are the 2,000-3,000 mid-size companies that have low volatility, low equity, no prospects, very little, you know, that the odds that they're going to become the next Microsoft or Apple are 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000. Those companies need a better capital structure, and their capital is T-bills. And T-bills have a vol of 5.
Right.
And that makes them, you know, and so here's the problem. A, they're dilutive. You're holding T-bills and you're probably losing 9% versus cost of capital every year. And so you're basically bleeding 9 to 10% of your capital every year. And then second, they're not volatile, so no one wants to trade your stock, so your options are worthless and you can't. And then what's your cost of capital if you have no volatility, Chris? It's 10%. You have to pay 10% interest. So if you have no capital, it costs you an obscene amount of money to borrow when you need it. But here I'll give you the perversity. MicroStrategy doesn't need capital. We have 150 years worth of capital. We don't need it. But we can borrow it for 70 basis points when we want. And so what is the world trying to tell you?
Yeah. I want to ask you a question specific to MicroStrategy. When I'm talking to my friends about Bitcoin and I'm trying to introduce them to the way that I'm thinking about it now, the one question that keeps coming up is, why is Michael Saylor selling so much MicroStrategy stock? If, you know, he's long term and he's always going to be perpetually buying Bitcoin at the top and he's down for the long haul. And then I got somebody shows me a Bloomberg chart of insider sells on MicroStrategy and all I see is red. And so I'm just wondering if I could ask you about that.
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. In the year 2014, it was like April of 2014. I was given a stock option as part of my compensation for 400,000 shares. And that was a 10-year stock option. And it expires worthless after 10 years if I don't exercise it. And so I think the expiration date was like April 25th or something like that. So about a year ago, I said, well, eventually I'm going to have to exercise it. So how do I do it? And if you go back and check out our conference call, on our conference call sometime in like the October-November timeframe, I just told all the shareholders I'd put in place a 10b5-1 plan, and that plan is to sell 5,000 shares a day every day for 80 days, 80 trading days, and the last 80 days at the end of the window. So I held the option to the longest time I could for 10 years, and then I have to exercise it. So I wasn't actually selling shares that I owned.
Got
My shares I'm actually holding. What I was selling, what I was doing was I was exercising the option granted a decade previous. I was selling into the market in order to pay the cost of the option and banking the money, because that's my only choice. But really, it was that or the option expires worthless. And the reason you saw continual reports is every day you have to report those.
Right.
I mean, public companies have total transparency. So every single day you could see exactly, it was 5,000 shares. You could see the price they were sold out. It was all programmatic. And the alternative would be maybe to do it without a 10b5-1 program and try to do it in 3 days. But that would have been, you know, much more anxiety inducing for everybody. Sure. Because there are lockup periods, and then people are thinking, well, which 3 days? Why did he pick those 3 days, et cetera? So I was trying to be as graceful and transparent as I could in something that I kind of needed to get done.
Yeah, I knew the answer. I just wanted to hear you say it. And also, you know, to be frank with you, something I, you know, years ago would swear up and down I would never say, but I'm going to say it right now. And I said to my one specific friend that I was arguing about with this, which is that you've been right. And so if you want to sell stock, you deserve to, you know, the stock's up fucking whatever. It's up 10,000% over X amount of time. You know, at the end of the day, you've been right. And so you should be afforded, just like any other CEO, the ability to sell stock. And, it, you know, if it was preordained under a plan that started 10 years ago, you know, you taking on the risk in 2014, when many people would have said Bitcoin will be at zero by now, I think entitles you to it even further. One last thing I'm going to bring up, and I'm going to let you slide. Look, you know, Peter Schiff's a friend of mine. I'm somewhat of a Peter Schiff disciple. I learned a lot of what I know about Austrian economics from Peter Schiff. You remind me of him a lot. I was thinking about this as I started to, you know, I am familiar with a lot of his lectures and everything he's done. As I started to listen to your library of podcasts, Lex Fridman, all these multiple hour-long podcasts that you've done while I've been out running, you remind me a lot of him because, A, I think you're both well-intentioned, as I said before, and I can almost visualize I can almost see the two of you, you know, I can see everything making sense in both of your heads. Like, you know, you both honestly believe that you've come by the right solution, and that you're seeing things in a way where, you know, no air can kind of get out of the there's no margin for error, there's no other option, and no air can kind of get out of the system. So the first question is, and these are my last two questions, first question is, what are your biggest fears as it relates to the integrity of the network? Somebody had mentioned to me once maybe core developers, then there's the question of quantum computing. So I'd love to know about what your biggest fears are. And the second question is, will you come on and debate Peter Schiff on my podcast?
I think that Bitcoin the network has won the crypto wars, and as a crypto asset, it's won, and it's destined to grow from $1 trillion to $10 trillion to $100 trillion, and so it's winning. So just like any empire or any winner, what's the biggest risk? The biggest risk is that the people within the network get fat, dumb, and happy, and then it's overcome by what is the word?
Gluttony.
There's this tendency for people in successful countries to then meddle and then want to fix things that aren't broke. Right. Like, so
mission.
So
creep.
Really, the biggest risk to Bitcoin is all of a sudden, charismatic, well-intentioned developers decide to improve it, and they introduce instabilities by attempting to improve it. Just like, you know, in a country, oftentimes the countries, when they're commercially successful, then the people that are successful in the country introduce all these social programs that then corrupt it or destroy it. So
it's like warning about the hurricane.
Well-intentioned idealist within the Bitcoin community corrupting the protocol.
Okay.
That would be the risk. I mean, it won't be defeated from without. It'll be that, people forget that less is more. And remember how I said everybody always wants to do something?
Yep.
It's like, so there's a joke in Bitcoin. I just heard about Bitcoin. I'm here to fix it. Well, it's just like, oh, I've been in Bitcoin and we haven't fixed everything in the world. So I've got an idea to change the underlying protocol to fix some other part of the world. So I really think it's idealistic, lobbying to corrupt the protocol. That's the thing that we have to be humble.
Right.
And humility is like, it's successful without your new idea. You see?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to then, volunteer how they would make Bitcoin better.
It's just not in our nature though, sadly.
Yeah. It's like, so my view is, you want to do something that's not in the core protocol, do it on a layer 2, do it on a layer 3, do it on a layer 4, but don't F with the network. Like, it got to be $1 trillion without your idea. So you ought to be, you should be very careful. Some people, they'll say, well, that means you never want to do anything to the software. That's not true. I think you should maintain the software. You should protect, you should focus on safety, obviously fix problematic bugs, be focused on security, integrity, all these things. But I just think, radical progressive proposals to quote unquote upgrade the functionality, the performance of the network, that's the risk. The last time that happened was Roger Ver and the big blockers and the block size war.
Right.
It's like it always starts with, well, Bitcoin needs to be more scalable, it needs to be faster, it needs to be better. Someone will come up with that and it creates a fork. And they were wrong. And you could see that Bitcoin Cash failed and Bitcoin Satoshi Vision failed. But when you think about Bitcoin, it won't be defeated from without. It'll be an idealistic, radical proposal from within, someone that thinks that they can do it better, right? And so, and I don't think it'll succeed. I don't think the risk is that that would happen. I think the risk is just a fork, at some point, and another one of the big blocker, small blocker type struggles, And so that's a simmering discussion in the community that goes on. And I just think we always have to be humble and conservative, right? And what I would say is developers are like the lawyers in cyberspace, and there's the good lawyers that help you when you're in trouble. There's the bad lawyers that run around suing everybody to make money. And then there's the ugly lawyers. They're the ones that think they should run the country, pass a law, and tell you how to live your life to protect you from yourself or to keep the world from the oceans from boiling, right? And more lawyers doesn't make for a healthier society.
Sure.
Not when they get to the point where they control everything and there's a million laws. And developers the same way. There's the good developers. They protect the software, make it run, keep it from falling over. There's the bad lawyers always attacking, trying to raise money or benefit themselves by, spinning up something. And then there's the ugly, developers. They want to actually take over the entire network and regulate, censor, control. And they always do it in the name of scaling the world. Well, we need to do this for the good of the world. And that's why you need to give me this power. So that's the risk. And you got to manage that. In terms of Peter Schiff, I think my issue here is we mostly agree on the problem. We just have two different solutions. And my solution is technology, digital capital, a la Bitcoin. His solution is gold. But I don't see this any – it's not constructive to debate him because he hasn't changed his position in 15 years while Bitcoin's gone from like $1 to 66,000. And he doesn't introduce any new arguments. All he's doing is just arguing in favor of gold. And at the end of the day, Peter Schiff doesn't own gold. And so
he does own gold.
He said, for the record, most of his only a small portion of his portfolio is gold. And he's not even majority invested in gold. He doesn't have $1 billion in gold.
Well, half of his portfolio is in miners, which has actually more disproportional.
Okay, but the point is, those miners are short gold, Chris. They're short gold. They're selling gold every day in the market. So the point is, if you're arguing in favor of investing in gold miners, well, you might as well be arguing in favor of investing in like soybean farmers or natural gas drillers or whatever. You're an industrial analyst promoting industrial stocks, which is fine, but that's not money.
Well, he would disagree with you that they're short gold. What he would say is that, you know, if the price of gold rises, miners are going to rise as a multiple of that, because you're essentially long gold with leverage, which is very different than being short.
Yeah, I don't really think it's constructive or a good use of anybody's time. Peter has been debated on this topic for a decade. I mean, like, heck, when I got into Bitcoin in 2020, one of the reasons I bought Bitcoin was because I saw the Eric Voorhees Peter Schiff debate from 2017. Like, he wasn't persuasive in 2017. He hasn't been persuasive since. I think that it's a disservice to actually, you know, to promote that in general. And by the way, I think the elephant in the room here is, I don't think you can find a single person in the world that owns $1 billion worth of gold. Challenge you to find one. Yeah, go find me a person that owns $1 billion worth of gold bullion as an investment, and then bring them. And if you can find me that person, Chris, I'll debate them. I will debate them. If you can find me a person that bought legitimately $1 billion of gold as an investment, and they want to debate me on your podcast, I'll do it.
He might lever up and do it just so he can have the chance to debate you. But listen, Michael, hey, man, listen, a couple things. I appreciate your candor very much. You know, you came on. We did not prepare anything in advance. You knew this was going to be unscripted, unedited. There were no constraints as to what I could ask. And I appreciate you being kind enough to come on after years of gratuitous amounts of shit that I gave you, which I don't know what else to tell you other than I apologize for that. And I genuinely appreciate you your forgiveness via email.
You know, I appreciate the fact that you're open-minded about, at least about Bitcoin, you know. Like, I was against Bitcoin before I was for it. It turns out that most people are against it before they're for it, and that's not an uncommon thing. And, you know, so the fact that we can work through that is good. And ultimately, the thing we all agree on is there's a problem in the world. There's an economic problem, and everybody faces it. Every company, every government, every individual investor, every institution faces it. And now the most constructive thing we can do with our time is work through the solution. You know, what is the solution?
Right.
So, you know, so Chris, you say, like, Mike, what's your solution? What I'm saying is, it's very simple. It's take some portion of your long-term investment portfolio that you want to hold for a decade and buy Bitcoin with it, because you're joining into a network of smart money with a bunch of other people, and you're going to be benefited by macroeconomics and the advance of technology and education, right? That's my solution. I can't in good conscience recommend any other particular thing. I know there's 10,000 other investment strategies, right? And I don't dispute people are going to make money investing in other things, whether it's real estate, buildings, stocks, art, whatever it is they're going to invest in, sports teams. Well, it's full of it. I happen to personally think that buying gold is a bad idea. I think Bitcoin is buying a good idea as two assets.
You think it's a bad idea? You don't think they could coexist?
I think Bitcoin's going to demonetize gold. I think that Bitcoin has everything that gold had the promise of. And so gold was the best idea in the 19th century. I think Bitcoin is the best idea in the 21st century. I think you do a disservice to the world and to the investing public to suggest that there's any parity between the two, because one of them, if Bitcoin works, I don't think gold can work. I think it's pretty obvious that if Bitcoin works, then there's going to be a massive flow of capital out of a non-sovereign bearer instrument, store of value, that is a physical shiny gold thing, right? So So what you're doing is when you're buying gold, you're hoping that people don't discover Bitcoin, because if they do, there's $1 trillion to flow out of gold and then the price will collapse. So I think it's risky. I would much rather, I mean, and if you look at the performance, Chris, I would much rather people say, I'm not convinced by Bitcoin, I'm just going to buy the S&P index. At least they're getting a piece of Microsoft and Apple and AI and self-driving cars or whatever, right? I mean, if you're not going to buy Bitcoin, I would rather you buy scarce desirable real estate that wealthy people are going to want to buy from you, or buy big tech, high tech, you know, stocks that can make 1 billion cars drive themselves. I mean, at least you're tapped into the future. I just don't think, I would say don't buy weak currencies. Don't buy the peso or the bolivar or the Naira. And don't buy a weak commodity. Don't buy any commodities. Commodities make shitty money because people keep creating more commodities. And I don't think I'm wrong, Chris. And I think that if you look at the numbers and you look at, crunch all the numbers and all the stats for the last 100 years, what you're going to find is that the best performing asset classes are real estate or the S&P index or collectibles or scarce art or maybe trophy sport teams. And I think you're going to find the worst performing asset classes, commodities, basic vanilla commodities, number one, dead last, and then gold, you know, pulling up the rear, and bonds and currency derivatives. So there's nothing revolutionary about this. It's very much conventional wisdom. All I'm doing is just noting that there is a digital commodity, which is truth, not a commodity. It's a scarcity that works as a capital asset that gives you all the upside of big tech and also gives you the fungibility of bonds and also gives you the desirability and scarcity of luxury property. And it's all rolled up into one thing, and it's called Bitcoin. And it's worthwhile for people to spend 100 hours and figure out how they feel about it.
Michael, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today. It's very kind of you. And just great, wonderful talking to you. Wonderful getting a look into your head.
Okay, thanks for the opportunity, and best of luck with your work, and thank you for working to educate the public. I think that it's a benefit to the world, and I wish you the best, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, Mr. Saylor, take care.
Bye.
That was Mr. Michael Saylor of MicroStrategy. I really appreciate him coming on, as I said, especially after the amount of gratuitous shit I've given him. Says something about a guy. Either he's trying to hawk Bitcoin so much so that he doesn't care about how much shit I gave him, or he's just a humble person. And I like to think it's the latter there. Just going to reiterate real quick, this podcast is not financial advice. I'm not a financial advisor. Please do not make any financial decisions based on anything in this podcast. Speak to your personal financial advisor, somebody with a license, somebody that wears a bow tie, somebody with some kind of certificate on their wall, some shit that I don't have. Please reach out to them. This podcast, not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities, crypto, commodities, or anything at all. I want to thank you guys so much for listening. I have a couple of great guests coming up. For right now, I am out of here. Thank you again to Mr. Saylor and to my sponsors, JM Bullion, Rebel Capitalist Pro, and Swan Bitcoin. But for now, I am out. Peace.